following podcast is part of the Underdog Sports Podcasting Network. For a full list of our shows, as well as breaking sports news and engaging feature stories, visit us at www.theunderdogsports.com.
Dog sports, but we came here to win. The most legit podcast, that's why we know you're tuning in. We cover the biggest news, we underdogs, but we can't lose. So trust the process, yes you, cause we got Chris and Anshu to bless you. With the best features, best stories, we diving deep like a Lambo leak. Wake up kid and stop snoring, we on point just like this beat. Bring the passion like the dog pound, in the cold get a gold brand. Sit back and raise the cap cause we start this show like right now.
Welcome to The Underdog, episode number 55, take two. I'm Chris Forwardell. Anshu's still away with that whole marriage thing. Joining me again this week, the great Tyler Lurie from Create Your Shot. Tyler, thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I guess last week I was the fill-in co-host. This week I'm the fill-in for the fill-in co-host. So getting my utility man reputation ramped up, I guess, this week. But happy to be back. Thanks, thanks for letting me come back on. I enjoy it.
Absolutely. And thank you to David McGraw from Sunny and PHX and Tony Conti for talking to me yesterday. Unfortunately, we had some audio issues and I guess it was fate just wanted Tyler back on the show. So here we are, and we have had an interesting couple of days in the basketball world. You know, I talked to Dave about this yesterday, and now we're starting to see a little bit more information come out, and people are starting to deny things. But what was your take on this whole Houston Rockets, LA Clippers thing?
Well, so full disclosure, I went to bed before, so did not make it up to the end of the Inside the NBA sort of clip about it, but I did think that Shaq and Chuck laughing while the Inside the NBA reporter was talking about it was one of the funniest TV clips I've ever seen. I mean, just like so hilarious, and they were like, oh, this is Chris Paul, gotta call the cops. But what I don't understand is what Austin Rivers could have possibly said. No. And then what went through the guys on the Rockets' minds that, like, what were they going to do when they got into the locker room, Chris? That's what I don't get. Like, I know this whole, like, the LAPD was called and, like, the situation could have gotten dangerous. Like, what were Trevor Ariza and James Harden and Chris Paul, like, what were they going to do? Because we've heard plenty of stories of guys fighting each other. Just this weekend we heard that there was on Martin Luther King Day, we heard there was an altercation between Kyle Lowry and Ben Simmons after the game, after they both got tossed. So, like, what is sneaking in the back door of the locker room going to accomplish?
And what is getting – well, originally it was Clint Capela. Now it's coming out that it might have been Tariq Black.
Tariq Black, yeah. Mark Stein reported that. That's phenomenal investigative reporting, by the way, Chris. That's unbelievable by Mark Stein, you know?
Earning his money, for sure. And by the way, kind of racist for the people who got it wrong in the first place. Just saw a big black guy and assumed it was Clint Capela.
So I refuse to be a name dropper, but I have a very close friend who used to play in the NBA, and I asked him on, I guess this was what, Monday night, I asked him on Tuesday kind of like what he thought about it, because he's a big guy and he's guarded Blake Griffin before, and I said, you know, like, it seems like a lot of people want to go at Blake Griffin, and he told me that, like, Blake never really talked when they played, like, never talked trash, never was kind of a jerk or anything. But I guess, like, Chris Paul does have a reputation of being very vocal both on and off the court and with his own players, obviously. So I do wonder if maybe Chris Paul was kind of unhappy about the game, was disappointed that they were losing, and he wanted to start something. And I know that he's always kind of thought that Blake Griffin was a harder guy to play with. He didn't necessarily care as much about basketball as maybe CP3 would have wanted. So I don't know about that. And I have no idea what Austin Rivers must have said. Like, because that was apparently who everybody really wanted to get after, right, was Austin Rivers.
Yeah, and that doesn't bother me, because Austin Rivers gets on my nerves too, and I understand the impulse to want to punch him in the face, but I don't know what exactly he could have said. How do you take it that far over the line on, you know, it's funny, on Martin Luther King Day we have all this fighting. Come on, guys.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting weekend in terms of fights. And then just to harp on this Ben Simmons thing for a second, you know, I'm a I'm a Temple alum. You're a Nova guy, you know, so we know about Philadelphia between the two of us. But, you know, Ben Simmons probably couldn't have picked worse people to try to. So he's gotten an altercation in London now with Marcus Morris. Mm-hmm. And then he gets an altercation with Kyle Lowry. Like, he should really stop messing with North Philly guys. Right. I'm just going to say that. Like, if Ben Simmons is listening, just those aren't the guys to mess with. Because whether or not they're going to come get you, like, they might have some people that will take care of business for him. And I don't know if Ben is quite ready for that yet.
Yeah, in terms – so that was an interesting thing. And I thought – watching the clips, I think it's really funny because you can clearly see Ben say – meet me in the locker room and go and gesture towards the tunnel, or meet me in the tunnel and gesture towards the tunnel. And then there's just this look on Kyle's face. It's like, oh, all right. And he immediately walks to the tunnel. You know, we've heard that, you know, nothing actually happened. Kyle said that Ben didn't show up. Ben just went back to the locker room. And that's what should have happened with all of this ridiculousness going on and all of this posturing between two guys. But I couldn't agree with you more. Lowry's not the guy.
Yeah, of the list of people in the NBA like not to mess with, he's pretty high on that list. I think, like, from what I've heard from my time there and everything I've heard, that James Johnson is probably number one, that, like, he just doesn't care. I've also heard Trevor Ariza is pretty high on that list. So maybe if he did get into the Rockets or get into the Clippers locker room, that maybe he would have caused a problem. But I was going to say, the only time I think I've ever heard of a guy actually getting an altercation after a game, I think Jerry Stackhouse and Kirk Snyder fought, or Jerry Stackhouse maybe threw hands a little bit. I don't know that Kirk Snyder actually fought him. I don't know, man. Part of me wonders if this is taking things a little bit too serious. You know, I've never tried to fight somebody at my office before.
Right. Well, maybe that's why you're not advancing as quickly as you'd like to.
you're probably right. And I'm curious as to the next, like, altercation is going to be. Because,
well, we had, you know, it,
we need to get a.
We had it last night.
We did, actually. Aaron Aflalo, right? Aaron
right.
Aflalo.
People can't stop.
How about if he connects?
NBA? I don't know, man. Yeah.
He threw. It wasn't quite Shaquille O'Neal haymaker to Brad Miller, yeah. Where, like, if Shaq had connected, I don't know that Brad Miller would still be here today.
He's dead.
But Aflalo lined up and I mean, he swung as. First of all, it's a pretty embarrassing punch because
it was
how you, like, punch at, like, you know, 10 or 11 years old when you're, like, having a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he really wanted to go after Jalika. I don't know how to say his last name.
You know what it looked like to me is it was like it's that test your strength thing at the carnival, that punching bag you're trying to hit. And he just wanted to hit it as hard as he could. Did not care about form. Did not care about where it landed. Just trying to go for maximum impact.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. It's been a good week for the NBA grabbing headlines back after, you know, Saturday and Sunday were probably, I would say Sunday was the best 7 straight hours of football I think I've seen in a long time. So good for the NBA, you know, stealing some headlines back before the conference championships.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure that these are the headlines that the NBA really wants, though.
They just want, but they get viewers. They just want viewers. And anytime you, like I said, anytime you get Shaq and Chuck and Kenny laughing and yelling over Ernie Johnson to end a night, it's a pretty good night in the NBA. TNT is very, very happy.
Yeah, oh, for sure, for sure. And, you know, it got progressively less interesting in terms of the individual battles and the individual altercations. Because, I mean, it's hard to say that Aflalo and Bellicia is – that's your headliner for the evening.
Those are two guys – to be honest with you, I went to a Wizards game earlier this year when I was home visiting my family. And when Aaron Aflalo checked in, they were playing the Magic, I was stunned that Aaron Aflalo was still on the Magic. And this is from somebody who considers themselves a pretty hardcore NBA fan. And, you know, I watch at least 82 Wizards games a year, but then a bunch of other stuff on League Pass when I got time. But I guess, like, I'm not that interested in watching the Magic because they're just totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
But I could not believe Aaron Aflalo was still playing. Like, I hadn't heard his name in probably a year, Chris.
He's one of those, I mean, he was a king for a while, like 2 years ago, I think. Maybe even last year he was a king. He's just one of those guys who's just always around. He can score 11, 12 points a night, and, you know, there's going to be a job for him if he wants it because this is a scoring league. He's the Harold Miner of modern day NBA if Harold Miner wanted to stick around and score some buckets? We lose you, Tyler?
I'm saying I think that he's a guy. Sorry about that. I think he's a guy now. He's on like a minimum deal, and you know that he can make threes, right? Like he gets out of bed shooting 35 or 36% from threes. So like somebody will probably give up a highly protected second round pick that's in the playoff hunt and be like, oh, we think Aaron Aflalo can make shots for us. But I don't know. I think he's probably done. You know, the days of him being – you know, three straight Final Four guy at UCLA and people being like, oh, how good can Aaron Aflalo be in the NBA? I think those are just about done. But, man, he's had like a 10 or 11-year career. He's made a ton of money. I was, like I said, I was surprised. I had not heard his name in a good while, and the headline he makes is throwing haymakers on national TV.
So are we talking like top 55 protected second-round pick?
Yeah, that's the type. Or the one that it just ends up like – and it ends up like being cash. You know, where like it ends up being a follow for nothing, because like I said, I think he's on the veteran minimum this year, and I think that's, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of like probably for him like $1.5 million or $2 million.
Yeah.
So a team can afford to probably take a flyer on it and give up something that, you know, this year it's maybe it's top 55 protected, next year it's top 50, the third year it's like top 30, so it ends up being like a 2021 second round pick.
Yeah, I'm looking at our iTunes page right now, and look, I'm on the professional, so I'm going to jump over to Sports and Rec, Maine. But, you know, I will tell you, I've never seen this before, sir. One, Create Your Shot is the top-ranked show of any of our shows right now.
I actually thought – I thought our guest this week – I am not a self-promoter by any means, and I don't want that to be this. So. Yeah. But I actually, our guest this week was a guy, Mike Dunn, who a lot of people don't know much about him, you know, unless you just kind of follow his Instagram. But he was a Division II basketball player. And so my co-host, Chris Angelos, Smalls, he was an assistant at Philly U, but their paths didn't cross. But it, just in terms of talking to guys and be like, hey, who do you think would be good to have on the show? They give us Mike Dunn, and he's a professional shooting coach. And his story was, first of all, he's the best shooter I've ever seen on Instagram. I've never seen him miss. But he got in a car accident a couple of years after he graduated from school, and it kind of like changed his outlook on life. It was like a catalyst for change.
Sure.
And I didn't know that. Chris knew that when we started interviewing him, and I didn't know that. So probably bad podcast prep by me, because I do most of the outlines and Smalls contributes as well. But I didn't know that. So when he brings it up in the interview, I was like pretty shook, because I'm just listening and Mike's talking for 5 to 6 minutes, probably too long that you want a guest to talk. And I remember thinking to myself, like, man, this is an unbelievable story. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that, you know, I hope that the listeners, you know, take some time to listen to it, because I think for people, even in not in sports, it's an unbelievable story about like him deciding that he just was going to change the way he lived, because he kind of felt like he got a second outlook on life. And he knew, like, he was really worried he was never going to be able to play basketball again. Right. So he wanted to make sure that his profession had something to do with basketball. And it was just like, you hear those stories a lot. And it was probably the first time I'd ever talked to somebody that had something like that happen to them. And it was a pretty wild story. But yeah, Mike Dunn, and he's at See Mike Dunn on Instagram if you want to, you know, feel bad about your own jump shot later on, Chris, because he is a fantastic jump shooter. I think he made 10 threes in a game twice in his career at Philly U. I think he made close to 250 or 300 threes in his career. And, you know, Division II schools don't play quite as many games. So, yeah. But he'll tell you, never played defense, but he could he can stick open jumpers.
Where?
But it was cool.
Is he still – he's still kicking around in leagues around the Philadelphia area?
I think now he is just focused on building his – I know he plays pickup, but I don't think he plays in any sort of like the pro-ams or anything like that out there. I think he's just focused now on building his business, and that's Mike Dunn Shooting School. But like I said, really, really a cool story, and a different dude, like just really, really positive. And I was a little bit disappointed that I couldn't be more positive in my day-to-day life, if that makes sense, after talking to him.
He's one of those guys, like, just such a ray of sunshine that it makes you feel bad about yourself for not being closer to that.
Well, So the first thing he says, we taped it last Monday, and it was a rainy day in Nashville. We're driving home from work, and the first thing Mike says is like, "Thanks for being here. Like, Monday is my favorite day of the week." And all I was thinking in my mind, and I said this to him, I was like, "You know, Mike, I was really happy when I was driving home because I was like, thank God Monday's over. like, thank God we're one day closer to the weekend." And I said, and so we said to him, you know, kind of like, why do you think that way? And he was like, well, you know, for the longest time as a shooter, if you don't think you're going to make the shot, you're going to be a bad shooter. So I was like, man, if I think that I hate Mondays, well, I'm going to hate Mondays.
Right.
But if I tell myself that I don't hate Mondays, I'm going to feel really good about Monday. And I was like, it seems so simple, but like that power of positive thinking, I was like, maybe that's just something better I can apply in my daily life. It didn't work. I went out and shot some jump shots after the interview and I didn't make them. So it didn't work in terms of positive shooting, but
well, yet another negative against Mike Dunn and his ability to get people to shoot the basketball better. No, I did. No, I checked it out. Well, because you know, I do the Twitter stuff and all of that. So I was coming up with our Twitter listing for the page for your podcast, and I was bummed to see that he didn't have a Twitter account because it's not super easy to link an Instagram account on a tweet, just because we also want to link the show, obviously, and that gets a little confusing for people. So I was bummed about that, but I did check out his Instagram, and yeah, super impressive. You're right. Does not seem like he ever misses a jump shot. You wonder how much of that is edited, but either way, that's a good looking jump shot regardless. And love to see him get together with, you know, a guy who's playing in Philadelphia right now who seems to have forgotten how to shoot.
We did ask him about Ben Simmons and his jump shot form on the show, because obviously he's a Harrisburg native, but you know, went to school in Philly, lived there for a while. So we asked him who the best and worst current shooter based on form was. So the guys from Sunny and Phoenix will be happy to hear that he said Devin Booker. Like, that's the jump shot form that if he's going to tell a guy to like go home and watch somebody, said Devin Booker's got the prettiest jumper. DeAndre Jordan has the worst, and then he broke down a little bit of why he thinks Ben Simmons is not a great jump shooter right now, which was really interesting because, you know, as a guy that coached basketball, I was never a shot doctor by any means.
Right.
So it was really interesting to hear him say, you know, just in watching TV, like he could tell that Ben's hand placement is always all over the place. So he's having to kind of adjust when he shoots it. Like, sometimes he's got to bring his wrist in, sometimes he's trying to shoot across his body to make sure that his wrist doesn't get in the way. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So, and he's had a couple tryouts with NBA guys to be their personal shooting coaches. I'm pretty confident something's going to break for him here in probably this off season. And that's the hope, because like you want good things to happen to good people. But it was interesting talking to somebody who's a really good jump shooter.
Right. Well, let's get a GoFundMe started to get him to be Markel's personal shooting coach.
Well, his jumper looked better from the foul line recently, right? There were some videos of them in London, and it looked awful.
Yes.
The hitch, I'm sure you saw it. Kyle Newbeck tweeted it. The hitch was back. It was gross. It was so slow. And then what I thought was even worse about it, and I don't know if you noticed this, but he shoots the jumper. He bricks it. Yeah. And then he just immediately hangs his head. Like, he just, like, can't believe he missed another one.
Yeah.
So
he's frustrated.
I mean, we're getting down to the point where, like, does it even make sense to – is he going to play this year, do you think?
Okay, so this is part of the reason I was so depressed last – what was it, Sunday or Saturday? Whenever the – Monday, I guess, when the Celtics played the Sixers in London. Watching that game, obviously the Sixers give up yet another 20-plus point lead to lose the game. And here we are, and then you get these clips of Markel. And the clips of Markel, it's kind of reminiscent of when all we got from Joel for 2 years was these clips. And they were tantalizing, and you couldn't wait for him to get on the court. But now you get Markel, and it's interesting because if you listen to what Brett Brown says, he'll tell you that Markel still doesn't have full strength in his shoulder. And I hope that that's true, and I kind of believe that that's true watching him shoot. Because if you watch him take a pull-up jump shot off the dribble when he's guarded, watch him take the free throws today, his jump shot looks normal. But when you get a situation where he's shooting from a little bit further away, or in the troubling part of this, he has more time to think about it, you do see that hitch. So I wonder how much of that is he thinks it's going to hurt, or he thinks he doesn't have enough arm strength, so he has to sort of push from his shoulder like, you know, every seven-year-old in the world does. It's troubling. I would have, prior to that Celtics game, I would have told you that I expected Markelle Fultz to play against the Raptors in this past game. Once I saw that jump shot, I tweeted out that for the first time all year, I think it's a realistic possibility he doesn't play. Now, I don't think they want to do that. I don't think they want to hold him out for the year, especially if best case scenario, this is just an issue of he's getting strength back in that shoulder after the scapular imbalance or whatever they want to call it. So if that's the situation and they are just methodically getting, you know, re-strengthening that shoulder, letting him shoot further and further away, then I do think we're going to see him. Probably not, well, certainly not until after the All-Star break. But it's just hard because one day I'll see stuff like today with the free throws. I'm like, oh, that looks good. You know, there's a little dip, a little bit of a dip that he didn't have before. But that's okay because I like the release point and I like the shot more than I liked his Washington shot anyway, where he kind of shot the ball from over his head. But right. then you'll get that weird hitch and shoot from the shoulder on a jump shot. And like you said, perhaps the most troubling thing is you just see the despair immediately when he misses it. So I don't know. We're not going to see him until after the All-Star break.
That worries me a lot from a guy that in a perfect world, I think like a lot of people thought like he was very similar to like James Harden in the type of role he could play, where like he can be a primary ball handler. Like right now, that's not what he would have done, but you have Ben Simmons who can be a primary ball handler. But at this point, if you're the Sixers, like, I'm not saying that Markelle Fultz is not the answer or he is the answer, but you've got to be looking to try to draft probably another guy, right? Mm. Like if you end up with that Lakers pick, if it's the first overall pick, well, you know, they need wing help so bad too.
Sure.
But at this point, like you can't assume that Markelle Fultz, I think, is your point guard of the future. I don't think you can assume that.
I agree completely. And if it's the first overall pick, it's a no-brainer. Luka Doncic's a Philadelphia 76er, but it does get more interesting.
That would be good.
Yeah, I would be happy with that, suffice to say. But if it's six, it is a little bit more interesting because I think, you know, we had this top five in this draft originally, and I think maybe at this point that Trae Young has jumped in and Bamba has jumped out, and Bamba's now at the top of that second tier. So getting that six pick, which is I think where it stands right now, six or seven from the Lakers, it's interesting whether or not, you know, it would be ironic if it was Trae Young just because he has almost an identical shot to the awful, ugly shot that Markelle's putting up right now, but Trae's knocking it down from 35 feet away. Or a guy like Colin Sexton would work for me too. I always thought Colin Sexton could be a Lou Williams-y kind of player off the bench, an impact scorer. Maybe that's underselling him a little bit, but I like that fit. Somebody needs to score with the second unit. I've watched a lot of Philadelphia 76ers basketball, and I've learned that you just have to wait and good things do eventually happen. I'm not concerned this is going to be a thing that plagues Markelle throughout his career. I think by the time we get to next season, he's going to be at least very, very close to the Markelle of old. I don't think we're going to get that this year. I'd be surprised. But I don't think you're going to have to replace him moving forward. I hope he figures it out. Because what people don't get about Markelle, he is a people pleaser. And he is an incredibly hard worker. And I like these things quite a bit. But I think we also forget that he's a 19-year-old. And he wants very
right.
he knows what people want him to be. He's that third piece to this Philadelphia 76ers puzzle that's going to lead the team to multiple championships. And he can't do that right now.
So,
and he knows he can't do that right now. And I think that frustrates the hell out of him.
So actually, the reason I said that is like, I think at six, if the Sixers, I don't see a situation. I don't know. Maybe Trae Young has another couple performances like he did last night against Kansas State where he turns it over a bunch.
Yeah.
I don't really see a scenario where Trae Young's there at six, but I do think if that was the pick the Sixers had and Trae Young was there, I think they'd take him in a second. Mm-hmm. Because I do think one of the biggest issues right now is, like, they just can't shoot. They just lack of perimeter shooting is tough, especially mm-hmm. with Embiid shooting, like, 25% from three. And whether or not he will end up shooting that for his career, obviously his volume's not humongous from behind the arc, but I think if you draft Trae Young, or Colin Sexton. Like, they can both play with Markelle Fultz, so that's fine. Like, I don't think you're not writing Markelle Fultz off, but, you know, it's tough to get him in a situation next year if they still have the same, you know, like, wing depth that they have right now. I still think it's a little bit more of a difficult situation, I think. Now, you get one more year, you know, another year of Embiid, and hopefully, like I said, he ends up playing 65 games this year. Simmons will get better, of course. Robert Covington should get better. Dario, I don't really know. And he might be close to who he actually is. And I just think the Sixers, like, you can't continue – if you're going to be a title contender, which I think eventually they will be, I don't think you can do that with Jared Bayless and T.J. McConnell and, you know, like the other guys that they play – off their bench at the 2 and 3 spot. It's just those guys are tough. I think that's where they have to improve in this year's draft.
Agreed.
Which stinks, because, like, you know how much I like Mo Bamba, and at six, I think that's an unbelievable steal with what he brings to the table as a potential defensive game changer. But, like, I just don't think the Sixers can take Mo Bamba. It's hard. Sam Hinkie would say, like, yeah, like, for them right now, because you're getting out of the situation where, like, okay, we need as much talent as possible, and you're getting into the next realm of, like, okay, now we need to fill our roster out, because we know Ben Simmons is a star. We know Joel Embiid is superstars for whatever you want to call them. You know what I mean? And, like, we have Markelle Fultz. It's just, it's got to be a guard or maybe Michael Porter if he shoots the ball well enough.
Yeah.
But, like, it stinks. This is a weird draft for them. Like, you can take Luka Doncic, of course, but, like, you can probably take DeAndre Ayton and play him next to Joel Embiid, but that's a really awkward fit in today's NBA for a guy that's been pretty bad defensively for Arizona this year.
Right, and that also forces you into a lineup where you now have, you know, Embiid shooting 29% from three. One thing I will say is Embiid is finally practicing with the team, so I'm hoping that that's going to help get his shot back a little bit better from the outside. He shot, you know, 34% last year, down to 29% this year. He's never going to be a 40% three-point shooter, obviously. Guy's 7 foot, 280 pounds, but I think he normalizes around 35%, 34-35%.
Yeah, I would say, like, his jumper is smooth enough to the point where, like, he at least shoots corner threes, and as a fan of another team, like, you're concerned when he shoots it. Like, you might live with it because, like, he gets fouled at such a high rate,
yeah,
and he has the ball that it's probably better for him to shoot a three. But if he takes open threes, typically I'm like, okay, he can make that shot. Like, it's not ideal to have him shooting corner threes, which is good, because that's probably how he likely gets guarded, that you have to at least, you know, close out on him when he takes those shots.
What's, like, your take? Go ahead. I was going to say, what's your take on Trae Young? Because do you need to build an offense around him? I just worry he's so ball dominant that it's going to be tough to shoehorn him in.
Oh, man, I don't know. You know, I really don't know. And one of the things I'll say is that I had this argument with a guy who's a current D1 assistant. Not really argument, but we talk about Trae Young after he just went – I mean, he just went bonkers against TCU. I mean, it was ridiculous. Like, 16 straight in the second half when they're losing, like, getting guys the ball. I really like Trae Young. I think he's pretty similar to who he was in AAU. It's just that right now they've got better players around him. There's much more space. The shooting is so appealing, Chris, to me, because, like, that's a guy that fits anywhere. He's a point guard, so you've got to live with kind of like when Golden State originally drafted Steph Curry, you had to live with the turnovers, right? And the beginning part of Mark Jackson's coaching career, when Steph was really starting to play point guard in that offense, and he was a little bit more of a traditional point guard than he is now, when they were posting up David Lee and stuff like that, you had to live with the turnovers. I mean, you just had to. And I think you're going to have to do that with Trae Young, because that's just the type of guy he is. But I think the shooting plays, and I think given the amount of separation he can get because of his jumper, I think he's a really big-time prospect. I don't think you have to build a team around him, and I immediately think he can improve your offense. Now, I don't know how sustainable it is for him to shoot 40 to 43% from three.
Yeah,
but he's probably better than Steph Curry was as a freshman. Mm-hmm. I remember watching Steph against Maryland when it was like the Maryland team with like DJ Strawberry and those guys, and Davidson lost in the first round. But like, you could see it. Steph could really shoot. Trey's a little bit thicker, I think, but he might be an inch shorter, might not be as long. I don't really know his measurements. But man, the shooting is really appealing in today's NBA. And if that's the guy, and he's going to, you know, he's going to shoot 9, 10, 11 threes a game at 37, 38% clip.
Mm-hmm.
The passing's really impressive. I think I think he's a top three pick. I really do. Like, I think, in my opinion, right now, the only two guys I definitely like better are Doncic and Bagley. And then I could be talked into Mo Bamba just because I think the potential is ridiculous. But in terms of like DeAndre Ayton and Michael Porter, I think Ayton's motor is a little bit too on and off for me. It's hard to say like, okay, is this guy going to play hard? Even though from a pure potential standpoint, it's through the roof. And then obviously with Michael Porter, we talked about this last week, just don't know about the injury. Don't know if he's going to make shots. Don't know about the time off the court, if that's going to affect him. It probably won't, but I like Trae Young. And the other thing is this draft is just there's really what in the top 10, it's Trae and Colin Sexton in terms of guards. That's it pretty much, right?
Well, depending on what you consider Doncic, but yeah.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know, positionless basketball would say, like, Luka Doncic is just a great basketball player. I would probably say he's a two or three, but he can be a primary ball handler. I think Doncic is probably better in a secondary ball handler role.
Yes.
If you play him with somebody else who can control the ball a ton and use a ton of possessions, and then Doncic can be that second guy who makes open shots. He can go into pick and roll. But again, like, I just feel like Trae Young, the shooting is today's NBA to me. You know, I think we talked about this in September, like, you don't love it as much because guys just jack threes. And, you know, I'm watching the Wizards right now. They give up 75 points in the first half. It's not really a recipe to win. But that's the type of guy that's tailor-made for this NBA. A bunch of ball screens, bunch of open shots, sling the ball around the floor, use a bunch of possessions. Like, and I think it plays. He's always been that type of shooter from deep. He's always been able to have that type of range, and EYBL is the same way. So, I mean, I think this is a guy we're going to see. It's even possible he could rise a little bit higher too, just because I think GMs recognize the effect that Steph Curry has on teams, and I hate to put that comparison on a 19-year-old because it's you know, Steph Curry, we're talking about a guy who's put together one of the best 3 to 4 year peaks probably ever.
Yeah.
So it's unfair, but I think there's going to be GMs that are like, okay, we're going to build our team like the Warriors, and this is the guy you got to start with. And you get Trae on a rookie deal. Like, it scares me beyond belief to be an Eastern Conference team and have the Celtics get, like, the 2 or 3 pick and draft Trae Young. I don't know that they'll do it because they have, you know, Kyrie, who's obviously ball dominant, and they got some other guys. But, like, if I was an Eastern Conference, you know, as a Wizards fan, like, that terrifies me. Because, like, that's the one big neutralizer is if guys can make shots.
Right. The thing that always scared me before Trae Young emerged was Mo Bamba ending up in Boston and just completing that defense. But when you're talking Trae... Go ahead.
It feels like that's going to happen, right? Like, it feels like... I mean, it's hard to argue with the effort Danny Ainge has had the last 10 years, I guess. It's really hard to argue with it. But it just feels like this is the year where, like, right now, they don't rebound the ball amazing. Al Horford is a tremendous player. I think gets very little credit for how good he actually is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not a rim protector. And probably the best part about him is you can play him at the 4 and the 5, and they're super versatile. It certainly feels like Mo Bamba ends up there as a screen and dive big. And then for the next 10 years, I just have to watch Kyrie and Mo Bamba destroy the Eastern Conference once LeBron goes to the Lakers. And that's terrifying to me. It's super terrifying.
Well, I just want to point out that, once again, that pick will belong to the Philadelphia 76ers. So you don't have to worry about it this year. You just have to worry about who the Celtics are going to take with that Kings pick next year, which could be another very good pick in what could be a very strong draft. But in terms of Trae Young versus Steph Curry, at least their freshman seasons, it's not really even a comparison who was better. Trae Young's, you know, right now, Trae Young is 29-5, 9-8, 4-1 and 2 steals, shooting 39% from 3 and 82% from the line. Curry was 21-5, 2.8 assists, shot, you know, did shoot 40%. Their three-point shooting's very similar. Steph shot a little bit better. Trae shoots a little bit more. And their free-throw shooting was very similar. But in terms of points and assists, especially considering the level of play, not even a question Trae Young was the better player. Now, what I would have been really interested in when you guys were talking to Mike the other day for your show is if you have a guy, if you're a shooting coach and you have a guy like Trae Young who has, you know, let's call it an unorthodox but effective jump shot, do you bother trying to tinker with that and raise his release point at all so he's going to have a little bit easier time getting shots off? Or you just say, okay, you can shoot the ball, you just keep shooting the ball like this?
Yeah, he said he would never mess with that type of jump shooter. Like, the one thing – so the biggest thing for him was hand under the ball. Like, making sure your hand was like directly under the ball. So, and then he said like wherever your elbow goes is kind of okay because, you know, obviously every human is not the same in terms of their physical makeup. So some things are going to be more comfortable than others. But we asked him that, like, hey, when you get a guy on campus and, you know, he's making jumpers, what do you do? And he was like, I just reps at that point. Because he said that the other thing, too, to consider, and he said, like, he thinks this is one of the biggest problems. And what fans don't understand is when they're critical of a guy like, let me pick a bad jump shooter out. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, for example, sure. Right? Arguably had the worst jump shooting form I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But, like, for tens of thousands of hours, he practiced that jump shot. So the ability to change that jumper in a year is just it's really hard to do because you have to do so much work. So he was saying, like, if you take a good jump shooter and you even tinker one thing, well, then you might get in their head a little bit. Their confidence falters. All of a sudden their form's slightly different. They're not used to doing it. And either they're going to go back to their normal way or that one little tweak might hurt how they shoot jumpers now and make them a worse jump shooter. So he said, like, a guy like that, you never mess with their jump shot. I mean, the thing with Trae Young is I agree, like, the release is odd, but, like, the quickness of it is so appealing. Like, he just needs no space. Like, it's not like we're talking about our favorite guy, Lonzo Ball, where, because his jumper is so awkward, he physically couldn't shoot the ball going left. Like, Trae Young can shoot it off the bounce, like, going to the rim, like, going left, going right, step back, all that stuff. Like, he shoots it just fine. It's just that he shoots it a little bit different than – you know, he doesn't look like Brad Beal or Ray Allen or Klay Thompson and J.J. Redick in terms of, like, those jump shot forms where, like, if I'm a college coach and I see a kid like that, I'm thinking to myself, oh, man, he's shot thousands and thousands and thousands of jumpers in the backyard because his form is perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I would – the one thing I would want to do with Trae Young is I would want to see how – defenders that are like 6'4", 6'5", 6'6", with lots of length bother him. Because at the Big 12 level, there are guys like that, but there's not a ton, right? So the depth of defenders you can throw at Trae Young, even in conference play, like throughout the entire NCAA, is pretty limited. But let's say Trae Young gets drafted by the Lakers next year, right? Mm-hmm. Well, assuming all rosters are the same, like he can go to Oklahoma City and you got, you know, they can throw Andre Robertson at him, it's a 6'5 guy. They can throw Paul George at him, that's 6'7 guy. Okay, they'll have their point guard, and that's Russell Westbrook. He's 6'4. You know, like you have him play Golden State, and Steph guards him for some of the game. But then all of a sudden, you got Sean Livingston. There's a 6'6 guy. You got Andre Iguodala for possession. There's a 6'7 guy. So my concern would be, how does Trae Young handle NBA length and athleticism? Because he doesn't see that on a nightly basis now, regardless of how good the Big 12 is. And so that would be my big concern: is how does he do? How is he going to finish at the rim? And is that really going to affect how he shoots? And my thinking is he'll just, instead of shooting from 30 feet, he'll just shoot from 33 feet and it might not matter. But I worry about that because he's not quite as explosive. And I think guys, even really explosive guys, struggle right when they get to the league to figure out the right way to finish, even when they can get to the rim, because it's different looks. But I am pretty much a believer in Trae Young at this point. And I think you just live with the turnovers, because I even think at Oklahoma, I think the roster is a lot better than people think. Mm-hmm. Cam Ragusti is pretty good. I think Brady Mack is a really good piece. Christian James, I think, is very good, but like, he's not playing with a bunch of all league guys. So, you know, you're going to go to the NBA and he's going to play with 12 guys that were the best player on their college team, more than likely.
Right.
And I think that creates even more space for him. So,
for sure.
But I just wouldn't be caught up thinking like, this kid can't play point guard at the NBA level, because I just think that the idea of point guard at the NBA level now is so different than it was even 10 years ago.
Oh yeah. Like, I don't think there's a chance there's an issue we can't play point guard.
Yeah. And like I said, maybe the shooting slips a little bit. Like, what's this? Like, do you, out of curiosity, do you know? I know he's shooting slightly less than 40% from three, but is he shooting still like 48 or 47% from two?
We'll keep talking and I will have that number for you.
Yeah, because like, I thought he was like 40, 59 or 50, 40, 90 for a while. And I know his free throw shooting is like right at the bottom of the 80s, but I wasn't sure if he's, you know, had a couple interesting games in a row where, like, you know, he has a bad game, like I said, against Kansas State, turns it 12 times. But I mean, his shooting will normalize a little bit. But I would imagine he's right around a 39-40% three-point shooter for his career, would be my guess. Because I just think there are so many actions now to see to get guys like that open shots.
Yeah, I can't find the inside the three numbers offhand, but no, I agree with you. And I don't like comparing players to all-stars and potential Hall of Famers, but it's really easy to see the Trae Young, Steph Curry comparison. You're talking about two guys.
I mean, that's the only guy, right?
Oh, yeah, two guys. Like, there is another guy, and it's a scary comparison, and that's a kid named Fredette.
Yeah, I think, though, that Jimmer, it's an interesting one, right, because Jimmer was such a big-time scorer. I don't think – the reason I don't like him as much, like, I don't think the Jimmer comparison is as good is because, like, Jimmer wasn't a 10-assist-a-game guy.
That's true.
And just to be clear here, like, knowing that Oklahoma plays a fast-paced type game, they're playing a bunch of games in the 90s, there are very few guys that have averaged 10 assists a game at the college level. Like, that just doesn't happen very often. So that's hard to ignore when evaluating him as a prospect, in my opinion, because like, yeah, you just don't see that happen very often.
Oh, no, we're talking about if he gets hot, you're talking about a 30-10 guy. That never happens.
Yeah. Like, I think he has multiple games of 30-plus and 10-plus, which I don't know off the top of my head how many times that's happened in the last, like, 10 years. Just because, like, the assist numbers, I mean, like, I think he has – and I still think his assist-to-turnover ratio, the last time I looked, I still think it was like 2-1. And that's
– yeah.
You ish. Want it probably to be a little bit higher than that, but I still think he was like right around like maybe 160 to 80 when I looked the other day. Might be a little bit less now because, like I said, last night he was bad. But I like Trae Young. I know I've just been gushing about him, but like he's a guy that I think he universally fits, whereas there are some other guys at the top of the draft where you're thinking like, okay, it doesn't necessarily make sense for this team and this team, but I do think you could just take Trae Young and plug him in pretty much anywhere. And it'd be harder with a ball-dominant point guard. Like, it would maybe not make sense for the Lakers to take him, but they wouldn't take him one overall anyway.
Well, so that's interesting. When we talk about – you talk about Young potentially going higher than people think. You know, we look at the teams at the top of the draft. Atlanta needs to change everything, but they do have Schroeder. Orlando is definitely a potential Trae Young team. Sacramento's got De'Aaron Fox. Dallas has Dennis Smith Jr. Memphis has got Conley, but an older Conley. And then, you know, it's the Celtics / 76ers pick, followed by Phoenix and Cleveland. You know, taking out the teams that basically have no shot to win the lottery, let's look at the top seven. Let me just get a quick yes or no. Would this team take Trae Young number one overall, at least seriously consider Trae Young number one overall? And let's start Atlanta. Would they?
Yeah, I think they would. I don't think they would ultimately do it, but I think they would consider it. And I think you can play him next to Dennis Schroeder.
Okay. Orlando?
I think like you have two guys that can that 100% would. They need everything. They need shooting in the worst way. And you can play him next to Elf for sure.
Well, yeah, or just bring Peyton off the bench. Sacramento?
Yeah, I think they would.
How? Come on. How do they take Trae Young?
So right now, right, they have Buddy Hield has come off the bench some. So they have De'Aaron Fox, but they also have George Hill. Like, their roster is very odd.
Yeah.
I think you're right. They probably wouldn't take him. I'll say this, okay? Instead of getting, like, practical for a second, every single team drafting one overall will consider Trae Young. But because guys do their due diligence. Sacramento, you're right. They would be much more likely to take – one of the fours. I think they would probably take Doncic or Bagley one overall would be my guess. But their roster is just so freaking weird. Like,
agreed. And they know it. They've already said they'll be sitting 2 to 3 veterans a game to let the younger kids play. Another way of saying we're going to start tanking now, but how about Dallas?
Yeah.
Dennis Smith Jr., a short-armed guy who is very similar in height to Trae Young, that would be tough to play those two together.
I don't think they would do it. I also think number one overall, I think Cuban would love to take another Euro, honestly. I think the relationship with Dirk is you know, so great. And he just does such a great job of marketing the team. I think that he would probably take Doncic one. I don't even know if it was like 3 or 4 if they would take Trae Young. But I will say this, if there's one owner that I think will do out-of-the-box things and say like, hey, we'll play Trae and Dennis together, I think Cuban could do it, but I doubt Dallas would draft Trae Young, even though that'd be a great, he would love to go there, obviously being from Oklahoma and, you know, his trainer lives in Dallas. But I don't think they would do it.
Well, I guess the argument would be that they're playing Dennis Smith Jr. and Seth Curry a lot together.
And actually, I guess I saw on Draft Express that Seth Curry is the closest size and measurement comparison to Trae Young. So they definitely could do it. But again, like, I wonder, I tend to think the GMs outthink themselves a lot. And so it's very possible that Trae Young is the best player in the draft. Mm-hmm. We probably won't know. And now that he's shot up the board so much, like, there's just no chance he's, you know, doing any sort of workouts like at the combine and whatever.
Right.
I wonder if somebody's gonna be like, okay, the athleticism isn't quite there, and they're just gonna talk themselves out of it, and he ends up going four or five, when maybe he is. Maybe we're thinking about unicorns incorrectly, Chris. Like, maybe Steph Curry is also a unicorn, right. And then, you know, you consider Trae Young that because the handle is really tight, like the vision is very, very good, like sees passes, you know, way better than other point guards do, and that's where I wonder, like, are NBA GMs just gonna be like, look, the hardest guy in the league to emulate is Steph Curry, so let's go get that guy.
Yeah.
Also, because I don't know if there's anybody that impacts offenses more than Steph Curry does, or impacts defenses, excuse me.
I'm officially ready to retire the term unicorn, because it just gets thrown around way too much now. Just way too much.
Yeah, how many unicorns, by your count, how many unicorns currently play in the National Basketball Association? Let's rattle them off, Chris. How many you got?
Well, I mean, how many are there, or how many are referred to as?
How many people have been referred to as unicorns?
Oh, God. All right. Well, Porzingis was the first one. So, you know, yep. Embiid, Giannis, KD. What else? Who else you got?
We had Dirk. Anthony Davis got called a unicorn.
Okay. That makes, yeah, I can see that. It's just too many.
I've seen Karl Towns get lumped into the unicorn category.
Oh, I've seen it. Apparently, unicorns can't play defense.
He's been better. I was being pretty critical of him, and I watched Minnesota like two or three of their last games, and he's actually been better. But I don't know. We can retire unicorns. So what are you calling your Giannis, Porzingis, Embiid type, and I would say Kevin Durant as well.
These like the guys that are cornerstones. That's a cornerstone. That's what that's always been. This is a franchise cornerstone. It's a guy you build the rest of the team on and around.
Right, because Ben Simmons is a unicorn too, right?
I guess. He athletically and in terms of skill set other than jump shooting, sure. I'm you know what? I don't want – Ben's not a unicorn. Ben is a very talented tall guy.
Yeah, we've seen – I would say we've seen – I hesitate to say more, but I would say we've seen – similar guy, Ben Simmons, like guys that are similar to him, you know, and your Lamar Odoms and,
yeah,
you know, and maybe not as quite as good of passers, but like there haven't been a lot of Porzingis and Embiids, and Giannis just has, in my opinion, just has one comparison. Like he's LeBron if he's as good as he can be.
Yeah.
And that's probably the best comparison to get. But Simmons, I mean, you can see it, like, you know, his floor is probably Lamar Odom, which ends up being a really good player. And if Odom played in the NBA now, he'd probably be – his career would probably have been a lot different than just a really good NBA player, you know. But
yeah, and it's just a matter of people giving him the opportunity to showcase his skills too. Lamar Odom was never – I mean, Lamar Odom handled the ball a lot. He was your prototypical point forward for large periods of his career. But the Clippers just never gave him the ball and said, hey, you're our point guard. And that's the opportunity Simmons has, and it's a unique opportunity to showcase those skills.
Now he did, though, in L.A., he did bring the ball up the court a lot and, like, initiate their offense. And obviously it was a triangle, so it was super slow, and Kobe shot it a million times a game. But he did bring the ball up a bunch with the Lakers. And I do think he did some with the Heat, too, you know, before he got traded. But Lamar Odom's an interesting case. Like, he's the guy for me. There's not a ton of guys that I wish I could have seen in different eras, but he's one of them for sure. Yeah, like, well, I just would have loved to see him in today's era.
Different circumstances altogether. You know, if Lamar Odom's one of those guys who, if he has his head screwed on right, he goes down as one of the great basketball players to come into the NBA in the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, you know, I worked with a guy at College of Charleston who played at Rhode Island with Lamar Odom and just said, like, just the nicest guy. Like, would give you the shirt off his back, like, just had so many people to take care of when he got to the NBA. I mean, I'm going to say a number, and I can't remember this exactly right, so just bear with me. I don't want people calling me a liar if they know this story, but like something like he was paying like 10 to 15 people's cell phone bills, his like sophomore year in the NBA, and you know, God knows what else he was paying for people in his circle. But I remember Tone told me, like, just Lamar was just a tremendous person, which is, you know, it's funny because, like, we talked about this a little bit, but guys get taken advantage of. And he definitely ended up having a long career. But you're right. If things break a little bit differently, we could be talking a whole lot differently about Lamar Odom than we are, which is just, like I said, but he just had a really good career, just a really good, like, third best player on a championship team, right? Like, fourth best player, maybe.
Well, I'm not saying he was a bad guy, but I don't think we can argue that there were demons.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's proved that since then, for sure. And, you know, I mean, he was a tremendous reality TV star for a while. Probably shouldn't take his TV career out of the equation.
Sure.
Great episodes of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Probably the only season I ever watched.
Afraid I missed those.
I don't know. You got to feel for a guy like
Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Of course you do. But at the same time, we make our own decisions. It's tough when there's 45 people on your back asking for stuff. But the reality of that is that kind of stuff is allowed to continue because it's not stopped in the first place.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you mentioned that. You see the story, just to take it from a non-sports topic for a second. You see the story about the kid, the 20-year-old kid in Florida who won the Mega Millions, Chris?
Oh God, yeah.
And he won $400 million.
Yeah.
Like, so he took the lump sum. How many people do you think in your life, if they found out you won the lottery, would immediately hit you up for money? Because I was going through that the other day, especially as a 20-year-old, when, like, you're so easy to take advantage of. I was trying to decide, like, where the cutoff would be in my lottery circle, if you will. And obviously that's a good bit more money than Lamar Odom had. But I just, like, I always think that's an interesting exercise to do, because we wonder about this, you know, not being millionaires ourselves. Like, how many people come out of the woodwork because they just need help, and you have cousins you've never even heard of before. But it reminded me of that, because I saw him say that with his $221 million, he's going to try to help as many people as possible. And all I was thinking was, like, don't help too many people, you know, make sure your money gets saved.
Right. Cut to 3 years from now, and he's completely broke, and he's gone through all that money.
Yeah, and you wonder how you spend $221 million. I don't know that I could, but people end up doing it, so people end up doing it.
Yeah, I've always thought about, you know, what would you do if you won the lottery and all of that? And, you know, I'm a little bit more practical with that, the financial side. And my position was always like, look, all right, so let's say we take home a check for $221 million. And look, you're going to get taxed on that. The tax rate's going to be about 40%. Let's call it 140 end of the day, 140, 145. I'm going to take, you know, let's call it $5 million. And that's going to be, I can do with this whatever the hell I want to do with this. I want to buy a house. I want to buy a fancy car, all of that. Great. The rest of it is going into a high yield savings account. And I'm going to live off of the interest of that for the rest
live
of my
life.
Live
off the interest.
Yeah. I'm not going to touch
it's the simplest
that.
Way to do it.
And you'll never be wanting for money again. Never. That interest is going to be astronomical every single month.
Like, exactly. Like, if you can't live off of 50 to 100,000 a month,
right?
Like, if you can't live off 10,000 a month, there's a problem.
Right.
But I would at least buy a beachfront property in Charleston, South Carolina.
Well,
that would be one thing I did with the money.
I would be in San Diego or Santa Barbara or Malibu.
I'm going to say, you're going to stay on the, what do they call it out west? The best coast. I can't abandon the East Coast. But yeah, I mean, I would be the same way. And then, like I said, I think I maybe would take the Marlins man approach, though. And I would just start buying, like, sick tickets to different games. Like, I would definitely be on, like, the 18th hole at the Masters, probably go to the Kentucky Derby, check off all the bucket list stuff, and then, just go start sitting behind home plate or sitting next to Drake at Raptors games, just trying to start trouble. You know, he was talking shit to KD the other night on TV, which was fun to watch, but I think I would probably just do that, and then probably nothing else.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
what else would you need to do?
Exactly. If I were in a situation where you know, I was in Philadelphia and I could go to the 76ers games every day, I bet your ass I would have courtside tickets for the 76ers. And I would have I'd get a luxury box, one of the luxury suites for Eagles games and Phillies games. Just even if I don't want to go, I want to know that I have it and I can just go to any game I want to, or I can send my friends to go to whatever game I, you know, I'm not going to.
So speaking of that, we've made it now probably right around like 50 minutes, and you have not brought up that the Eagles are playing at home for a trip to go to the Super Bowl, and we both probably have plenty of friends that are going to the game, and one of my friends hosts like a 50-person tailgate, and are you just not wanting to bring it up because you're just you don't want to jinx it? I mean, every Eagles fan I know is acting like this weekend's just another game, but let's be realistic here. Like, this is a big moment for Eagles fans. This is the NFC Championship. You haven't seen it since 2004, right?
Well, look, I'm terrified, and I think that's the the gist of this. Is I'm absolutely terrified. And by the way, if I would have told you before the season, if I were to give you odds on this, that the four quarterbacks left standing in the conference championship games would be Blake Bortles, Tom Brady, Case Keenum, and Nick Foles starting for their teams, what kind of odds do you think I could have gotten on that?
I think like William Hill Sportsbook would have just like happily given you like 50,000 to one.
Right.
And just said like, okay, whatever you want to bet.
Yeah, because absolutely.
It's so mind-boggling. Like, speaking about the Eagles for a second, I don't think Nick Foles is horrendous. I certainly don't think he's any sort of like starting caliber quarterback. Sure. But like, I thought Doug Peterson deserved a ton of credit. Like, I thought his second half game plan was so simple, and he allowed Foles to like get comfortable. And I told all my friends that were Eagles fans for the longest time that I think I would have rather played the Saints, because I don't really want to play a team that can generate a lot of pressure, because I think when Foles has to make plays by himself, it's really difficult. And so like, that's where I think the Vikings present a big challenge for him, because I think if it's like one read and like they can run the ball, great. But, you know, I don't know, like the Vikings defense obviously looked bad, but that was against Drew Brees in the second half. He's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. Yes.
So this poses a really interesting thing to me, because I thought Doug Peterson did, and probably Frank Wright deserves credit obviously too, but I thought their game plan against the Falcons was fantastic. I thought it was an unbelievably well-coached game, despite how weird it was.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you just this is a flip of the coin game for me, because it's going to be a matter of the best defense wins. You know, neither of these quarterbacks is going to put up 300 yards and four touchdowns. And, you know, saying that, both of them are going to go for like 405 touchdowns, like Ben Roethlisberger-esque numbers. But over the last 17 home games, the Eagles defense is giving up 14.2 points per game, and their last four home games, that number shrinks to about 8 points per game. So let me ask you this. Case off the board. We got a puncher's chance. Go ahead.
Let me ask you this about Case Keenum. Yeah. What are the odds that Case Keenum, before the season, called up the devil himself and was like, I will trade you anything you want to let me have a season of destiny? Because not even we can get into Stephon Diggs and what an amazing, cool moment that was. Like, my grandmother is a, you know, essentially a 50-year Vikings fan, and my mom actually called and was like, I'm going to call your grandmother to make sure she didn't have a heart attack when that happened. She's 90. But not even considering that throw and how absolutely unbelievable it was, but like his throw to Adam Thielen to get them into field goal range in the fourth quarter, where like he throws it off his back foot, sidearm to like the sideline, and Thielen comes down to it. Like, at some point, Case Keenum that we know is going to show up, right? Yeah. Like, it's just, it has to happen, or I am betting that he made a deal with the devil. Like, he had the horrendous pick in the second half against the Saints. After the Saints score, he just throws the ball into no man's land, and you're like, all right, this is over. And yet they went on a Hail Mary as time expires. So I like the Eagles for that reason, because I think that if their front four and their front seven can be as spectacular as it's been, and they were amazing against Atlanta, like Fletcher Cox was, you know, par for the course for him. He's tremendous every week, but like those guys have been awesome. I don't know how Case Keenum scores the ball, and that's what I think is tough. So I think the under is probably the play on Sunday night, I would guess. But I agree with you. Like, we could definitely look in a situation and the Eagles lose 10-6 because Foles throws a pick six or something, and they can't score touchdowns.
Right.
You know, on the other side.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, on the other side now, you got Jacksonville, who in a shootout makes the AFC Championship game. And are we just expecting that that Blake Bortles is, you know, he didn't make a deal with the devil. He's still been playing terrible, but he played okay on Sunday. But, like, I mean, Tom Brady, at some point, you know, their dominance is crazy, but, like, we got to talk about the quarterbacks that, like, he's had to beat to go to the Super Bowl. Like, before the season, if you're like, all right, Tom, you get a chance to play for your eighth Super Bowl, you just got to beat Blake Bortles at home to do it. Mm. You think he's just, like, smoking a cigar, laughing in your face? Like, okay, I'll see you in Minneapolis then?
Right.
It's wild.
Right. And then beat Nick Foles or Case Keenum in the Super Bowl to win.
I feel like it's almost – do you ever – you know, you get asked the question and the answer seems so simple that it just can't be right?
Yeah.
Like, you just sitting there and it's like, okay, who's going to win the Super Bowl? Like, obviously, if you're betting money, you have to bet on the Patriots. But there's just, like, some part of me that feels like it's just too easy. Like, it's just too easy for them. And we're going to see Blake Bortles throw for, like, 350 and five TDs this weekend, and somehow Jacksonville is going to make the Super Bowl. I'm not betting on Jacksonville, if that's what that sounded like. But it was like this weekend's games were just the only game that went how I thought it was going to go was New England and Tennessee. All the other games were awesome, super fun, very, very different. And, yeah, now we're in a world where – one of Nick Foles, Case Keenum, and Blake Bortles, potentially two, are playing for a Super Bowl in 2 weeks.
Well, let's not kid ourselves. One of those guys will be playing for a Super Bowl in 2 weeks.
Do you think there's a chance that – well, let me ask you this. In your wealth of football knowledge,
yeah,
how wild is it that the Patriots all year – They play a certain type of offense, and then in the playoffs, they just like, okay, we're going to go tempo and nobody can stop us. And they never really run it during the year, and then all of a sudden it comes out in the playoffs. Is there a chance Jacksonville can stop that? I mean,
no.
They have the number one pass D in the NFL. You don't think so?
No. This Jacksonville, here you go. This Jacksonville defense is full of unicorns on that side of the ball. And guys like Jalen Ramsey and A.J. Boye and Miles Jack and Calais Campbell and so forth and so on. But this Patriots offense and this team in general is so far above. It's 3D chess when everybody else is playing checkers. They're so far above everybody else. Jacksonville doesn't have a chance. I think their defense is great. I would love nothing more than the Jaguars to somehow sneak out a victory, you know, in a low-scoring game against that Patriots team and, you know, to have the Eagles play the Jaguars for the Super Bowl. But it's not going to happen. And that you asked me why we've waited 54 minutes to talk about the Eagles, and it's just because there's this looming sense of inevitability that even if you win this week, you can't beat the Patriots. And I don't know honestly if I would rather lose this week or lose to the Patriots in the Super Bowl. I think I might rather lose this week.
All right, hold on. How about this though? We know, and everybody who watches the NFL, don't have to be football experts like yourself, know if you can get pressure on Tom Brady, you can make him as close to normal as he can be.
Mm-hmm.
So the Eagles are the best team in the NFL this year generating pressure. So that's the only thing I'll say. I'm not saying that they can beat the Pats. I'm not even saying they can beat the Vikings. But if they get to the Super Bowl against New England, the one reason to be optimistic is that their defensive line could make life absolutely hell on Tom Brady. Now, that still doesn't say that Nick Foles can do enough to win. Like I said, I don't know that he can, but I would say as an Eagles fan, if you're playing the Patriots and everyone's like, okay, the Pats are, you know, 8.5 point favorites or something, I'm sure it won't be quite that high, but it could be. That would be where I would hang my hat is like, I've got, you know, a bunch of guys. I got Chris Long. I got Brandon Graham. I got Fletcher Cox. I got Vinnie Curry. Like I got guys that can get to the quarterback, and that's, you know, that's kind of been the book. Seems very easy when you say that because, like, obviously if you sack the quarterback 10 times, you're probably going to win. But
right.
The book on how you make Brady a little bit more human than he normally is.
Yeah.
But I just really wonder, like I said, if like with Jacksonville, I don't know, like something just seems to be up. Like, how do they win a game 45-42? Like, I wasn't even sure Jacksonville had scored 45 points all year.
Right.
And then they're going toe-to-toe with – Ben Roethlisberger had 460 yards and five touchdowns in a game that Pittsburgh lost. It's insane. Right. It was crazy.
And after that, their offensive coordinator got fired.
Yeah, I saw that. And then
production, apparently.
Yeah. Apparently, Todd Haley's just a jerk, right? Like, that's why he gets fired, because
world
he gets pushed over
a-hole
at Tequila Cowboy.
world-class a-hole. Yeah, and he's going to get another job really quick.
Well, I guess I do wonder, like, he's never going to be a head coach again, right, because of his time in Arizona. Like, he just was such a jerk. But, like, Josh McDaniels is getting another chance. Like, Mike Munchak, who's supposedly a good guy, is potentially getting another chance. Mm-hmm. But it's weird, right? Like, Todd Haley, I don't know what he must have done to the people in Arizona, because no one likes Todd Haley. Like, yeah. I've never heard one person say, like, Todd Haley, yeah, that's a pretty okay guy. Like, it's just always, Todd Haley's a dick. He deserved to get pushed over on New Year's Eve.
Oh, yeah. Innovative offenses, incredibly productive, you know, wherever he goes, and just he will never sniff another head coaching job. Just never sniff it. You know, and now, you know, I've talked quite a bit about my relationship with a Cleveland Browns fan, and nothing would make me happier than a spite hire of bringing Todd Haley in to be the offensive coordinator for the Browns. Nothing would make me happier.
So I know when the Browns come up, it means the podcast is almost over. So
we're not almost over. We have more to talk about. There's a whole lot of football being played, and this is not going to be the segue to the end.
So, Chris, of the current job openings, this is a good segue. Of the current job openings in the NFL, what is the most appealing for you, and who's going to be the most successful of the kind of like hot candidates of like McDaniels, Patricia, you know, obviously John Gruden counts, Matt Nagy, maybe Terrell Austin or Jim Bob Cooter get a job. Like, so of those, like, of the open jobs, what's the most appealing? And then which new head coach or potential new head coach do you think is going to be the most successful?
Well, how open are we talking about some of these jobs being? Because it seems like a lot of these jobs are filled, just not official at this point. You know, Shermer's got the Giants job. What's his name?
Yeah, I would say McDaniels. McDaniels has the Colts job.
Patricia has the Tennessee. Lions job. It's just a matter
Gruden's
of...
Gruden's in Oakland.
Right. Nagy obviously is official, and Gruden's obviously official. It's a matter of what happens in Tennessee, what happens in Arizona.
Yeah.
So those are the open jobs? The open jobs are Tennessee and Arizona?
Yeah, and like I said, I would assuming like all things are equal... Which job that opened do you think is the most appealing situation? You know what I mean? Like, if you think, even though that India is already full, if you think India is the most appealing, you get what I'm saying? Like, if you, if all the jobs were open, where would you want to go?
Okay. So let's rule some people out. Where wouldn't we want to go? I don't want to be a Giant. I don't want that Bears job. You know, the Lions are good, but how do you change that roster and get them over the hump with what they have right now? That's tough. The Colts is a wild card because you're talking about it's completely dependent upon the health of Andrew Luck moving forward. Where else do we have the Raiders? I think the Raiders unquestionably the most appealing job. What do you think?
I like the Raiders. I really like the Titans. Honestly, I like Mariota. I don't know if he's damaged beyond repair. But I think the Titans have a lot of talent. I think their run D is really good. Their pass D is atrocious. Their secondary stinks, but they've drafted receivers. They should be better. Derrick Henry looks like he might be pretty good. I think the Titans is good. I wonder how good Arizona is. Obviously, you don't have Carson Palmer. Maybe you could talk him out of retiring. That's happened once before. Right. But Arizona's not terrible, right? Their defense is still pretty good. I think the Giants is probably by far the worst job, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't like Chicago, that job either.
But their defense is young and pretty good. I guess it all depends. Like, do you think Mitch Trubisky is good? Like, do you think Mitch Trubisky is a franchise quarterback? So if that's a no, then, yeah, that's a quick one from you.
Nope, I sure don't. Mitch Trubisky is a lot like my dog. He is happy all the time. He's eager to go, and he's an athletic guy. But when it all comes down to it, I don't think he has. I don't want to call somebody dumb. I don't think he has the makeup to be an elite quarterback.
Now, do you think Derek Carr is an elite quarterback?
Ask me this 2 years ago, I say yes. Ask me after this year, I say no. I think he was playing not to get hurt a lot. You know, that's the first. It's tough when guys have those first significant injuries, especially at the quarterback position, especially on a team like that. because you are really afraid to get hurt again. And I think it took Carr longer than maybe some other people to get over that mental hurdle. I think he's going to be fine moving forward. And, you know, you have to like the offense that's on that team. But, yeah, I think I think he's an elite quarterback.
So then I guess, like, my next question about them is obviously, like, I doubt Crabtree is back there next year. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about Amari Cooper's down year, or do you think that matters more because you like Derek Carr was more affected by that and Cooper is a bounce back guy as well?
Yeah, I think that's completely related to the Derek Carr struggles, 100%. And I think when Carr starts to bounce back, you'll see Cooper bounce back. That guy's super talented.
I think so too. Obviously, like, the drops are a concern. Like, his drop rate has been really high, which I don't get, but he always seems like he's open, which is probably better, I guess. But I guess that's my next question about Oakland. Do you think John Gruden's a good football coach?
Yes. I think he's meant to be a college football coach, to be honest with you, because what we saw when he was in Oakland, when he was in Tampa, is those first couple of years, he will get guys to perform. But eventually, just the way he is, how fiery he is, how he's on everybody all the time, rubs people the wrong way, and people get sick of it, and people start to tune him out. So, you know, you take that into a college situation where guys are constantly – that roster's churning every couple of years. People don't have time to get sick of him. And also you're dealing with amateurs as opposed to professionals. You put him in a locker room with professionals where he's going to be there for in year three, it's going to be a problem. John Gruden's not going to hit close to 10 years on that contract. He won't hit 5 years on that contract.
So John Gruden is the Doug Collins of the NFL. Where guys are really great, you play a little bit better your first and second year, and then all of a sudden you're like, I need this guy to stop calling me and treating me like I'm his son. That's interesting. I was really surprised. I guess I wasn't surprised that John Gruden decided he wanted to coach football again. I was a little surprised he gave up maybe the best gig in media, obviously $10 million a year is one thing, but like, you got a cake job. Nobody's really critiquing you. You show up. He offered very little in the analyst booth. You know, everybody was the best player in the world and an all-pro. Right. And I mean, the way he would talk about bad quarterbacks made me feel like everybody was an elite quarterback. But like, I guess I was surprised that he walked away from that. But I guess, you know, Oakland comes calling a little bit. And I wonder if we're going to see, I haven't seen the details of his contract, but I'm curious if the deal's backloaded and the Mark Davis is going to try to sell the team when it goes to Vegas, because that's an awful lot of money to give to a head coach.
That's possible. And you have to look at it like this too. Like, it's not, don't think about it as $10 million a year. Think about it. He's leaving the broadcaster's booth for a guaranteed $100
million. $100
million.
$100 million.
Like, I would do it too.
We're talking about
I'm cool. I will leave this podcast right now.
We're talking about, if anyone wants to give us $100 million, we are able to be bought. We're talking about, like, how many players in NFL history have gotten $100 million contracts? So, like, Matt Stafford got one. I believe Andrew Luck got one. I believe Joe Flacco was a $100 million guy. I believe Albert Haynesworth got $100 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many other guys have gotten $100 million? And obviously, none of those contracts were close to guaranteed.
Okay, would you be surprised? Let's little game here. And again, I like to put you in a terrible position to make a guess here on the spot. How many players in NFL history have received a contract in excess of $100 million?
I don't know. I it's less than 10. It's got to be less than 10.
The number?
Seven,
26.
Eight? Is it really? There's that many $100 million contracts.
Yeah, we have. All right. Starting at 100, we're going to run through this real quick. Marcel Darius, J.J. Watt, Brett Favre, Albert Haynesworth, Michael Vick, Drew Brees, Justin Houston is at 101. All those guys were 100. Ben Roethlisberger's 102. Fletcher's 102. Drew Brees is Drew Bledsoe, 103. Matt Ryan, 103. Wow. Cam Newton, 103. Romo, 108. Rodgers, 110. And Ndamukong Suh is 114. Von Miller is 114. Oh, God. Andy Dalton is 115. Donovan McNabb is 115. Carson Palmer is 119. Larry Fitzgerald is 120. Flacco is 120. Kaepernick, 126. Jay Cutler, 126. That's money both of those franchises wish they had back. Michael Vick has two $100 million contracts,
the second being a 130.
Calvin Johnson is 132, and Andrew Luck is 139.
And now, obviously, that list is not updated because Stafford was not on there, and he got $100 million in the offseason. But hold on a second.
Right.
The one that stuck out to me, Larry Fitzgerald signed a $120 million contract.
Apparently. So that's Carson and Fitz right there next to each other. 8-year, $120 million contract from 2011 to 2018.
I am very, very surprised at that. I remember the Calvin Johnson deal because I remember it was a ton of years too. But yeah. I'm surprised that there's been 27 now, like I said, Matt Stafford. And then I believe in the offseason we will likely add two people to that club. I'm fairly certain Jimmy Garoppolo will get $100 million, and I would probably wager that Kirk Cousins gets $100 million as well. Okay. We know that the deals for quarterbacks are, you know, Andy Dalton's was nowhere near really $100 million because they could get out of it, like, you know, with the guarantees and stuff. But I would guess Kirk Cousins gets right in that, like, 4 to 5 year, like, 100 to 115 million where the, you know, let's say the Redskins can get out from underneath after the third year. But even so, like I said, I mean, it's crazy. Like, none of those guys came. What's the most guaranteed money ever? Probably not close to six figures. I mean, maybe Andrew Luck got 70 guaranteed or something. And that's where, like, with John Gruden, I just wonder, probably, I would say without a doubt, Bill Belichick is worth $100 million, right?
Sure.
I would say, like, he is definitely worth that. Is there anybody else in the NFL as a coach that you think is worth that type of money?
Okay, so here, I just have this right. Oh, you've got to be fucking. That's a word I can't say on this show. You've got to be kidding me. Sorry, I had the highest guaranteed sums up, and I got a spam box saying that, congratulations, user, you've been chosen for today's special reward. So I'm excited about that. See what else comes of that. All right, so here we are again. Most guaranteed money at signing. Stafford got $60 million. Jesus.
Okay.
Andrew Luck got $44 million. Carr got $40 million. So not sorted. Stafford 60, Sue 59, Eli 54, yeah, Luck 44, Flacco 44, Darius 42, Von Miller 42, Cam Newton 41, Olivier Vernon 40, Derek Carr 40,
right.
There's some other interesting names on that list.
So that's the thing about this Gruden deal, right? And exactly what you said, it's $100 million. Like, no matter what happens, he can be the best or the worst coach in Raiders history. He has signed a deal to pay him $100 million, and he is getting all of that money. And it is, to me, with the way that NFL teams are, it's astounding. Like, I think John Gruden's he's a good coach. I think he's. Mm-hmm. It's hard to win a Super Bowl even with other guys' players. There's too much that goes on in the NFL. You work too hard. Like, you can't be an idiot and win the Super Bowl, even if you got the best team.
Right.
Like, so. But, man, that's a lot of money, Chris. And I don't know, like I said, in this era, I think it all matters. Like, is Derek Carr who people thought he was at the end of last year? And if he is, then it's probably a great investment in John Gruden because he's never really had a great quarterback.
Yeah. No,
I think probably the best quarterback he had was Rich Gannon. So
it was a very, very good quarterback. Don't sell Gannon short.
Yeah. Yeah. Later in his career, and I think he had his best year, actually, with – the year after Gruden left, I think he won NFL MVP the year they lost in the Super Bowl. But yeah, really good player. And I guess, like, the other thing too is, like, how many good, you know, this is the perfect year to argue, like, do you need a great quarterback? Because you say it yourself, what were the odds you could get to get a Final Four of Brady, Bortles, Case Keenum, and Nick Foles? I mean, we have two guys that weren't starters at the beginning of the year. And then the third guy was benched for Chad Henne, who was so bad in the preseason that they were like, all right, whatever, we'll run it back with Blake Bortles and see what happens.
Right.
Like, that's literally kind of how the Jags decided who was going to play quarterback for them.
Least
it was like,
all right,
well, this guy's not that bad.
Yeah.
Right.
No, 100% right. True. 100% true. I just think he's going to wear on people. Like, you know, how is Marshawn going to react when Gruden calls him at 3:15 in the morning to talk offensive game plan? Like, not well.
I Yeah, I don't know about it. Like, Marshawn Lynch is an interesting dude. He's funny, like, but he's just a weird guy. Like,
oh, for sure.
He must like football. He must care about football. But at the same time, I just don't know. I don't know how he meshes with John Gruden. Just like I don't know how Derek Carr meshes with John Gruden, because, like, you know, Carr is probably the polar opposite of Marshawn Lynch. So, like, one of them is going to be great. But at the same time, I think it's important that Reggie McKenzie's there, just in the sense that he's been a very good general manager, and I think that matters. I don't think Gruden should have personnel control, and I think that'll help. But I think the Raiders do have a lot of talent. I agree. I mean, it's tough to say that, like, you know, Khalil Mack is absolutely elite. I mean, he's a stud. So you've got him. You've got Amari Cooper, who we both think is a bona fide number one. I definitely think Marshawn Lynch is a very good NFL running back. I think Derek Carr is a good NFL quarterback. Their offensive line is a lot better. I know they paid Kelechi, his last name, the guard. They paid him a lot of money. Like, so they have a lot of building blocks. And then the other thing, too, is, like, the AFC West, you know, Denver's drafting high. They could be pretty good with the quarterback, but because their defense is good, but don't know what's going to happen in KC, especially if they make the switch to Mahomes. Reed will probably figure it out, but they're probably 8-9-10-win team. And then the Chargers are good. I thought they were one of the better teams in the AFC this year and didn't make the playoffs, so who knows what's going to happen with them, too. And so, like, if I'm John Gruden, I got to feel like, okay, I got a chance to step in there and make the playoffs in my first year because I've got enough talent. Whereas with the other teams, other than maybe Tennessee, Detroit definitely you could. Although this year was a little weird, obviously, with Green Bay playing without Rodgers. So, you know, once he's back, you're probably the third best team in the NFC North. So that's a little bit tough for me. But I agree. I think Oakland's a really appealing job. So the only one I think is not appealing is the Giants. That's the only one that I think is really bad. Chicago.
Thank God for that, too, as an Eagles fan. Thank God that Giants job. By the way, Shake Milton led SMU with 33 points tonight, and they beat Wichita by 5 points. Big upset there.
Yeah, I saw a friend of Create Your Shot, John Rothstein. So all the listeners who are college basketball fans, we do have John Rothstein coming on in February. It's going to be a doozy because of, you know, how he is, but he did tweet Tim Jankovich, mad scientist. So I knew that SMU won that game without even having to look at the box score because I know what his shtick is. But it's interesting to me in this day and age in the NFL that we had as few coaching openings this year. I thought we would get some more. Like, I was totally stunned. We talked about Cleveland. I was stunned about that. Totally stunned Cincinnati decided to run it back with Marvin Lewis. Just an absolutely mind-boggling decision.
Really weird all around.
And then I was really surprised, and I had a friend here in Nashville give me an interesting theory, but I was really surprised Jason Garrett didn't get fired. Mm-hmm. And my buddy said that the reason he thinks Jason Garrett didn't get fired is because Jerry Jones is like wants to be the puppet master. So he doesn't want to fire Jason Garrett because he knows he can control everything from behind the scene.
Right.
But man, Chris, it's got to be pretty apparent as a Cowboys fan or even somebody, you know, the Cowboys are on TV all the time. I'm not a Cowboys fan, but that Jason Garrett is just not the guy.
Agreed.
Like, he's just not the guy. So those are some jobs where I'm wondering, like, you still have Dak on a rookie deal. You have Zeke on a rookie deal. Dez is obviously just done. But, like, how can you run it back another year with Jason Garrett if you're Jerry Jones, especially considering that Philly should be, you know, just about as good next year, assuming Wentz comes back healthy. Don't really know what the situation with Washington is, and the Giants stink. So if you're Dallas and Philly is your only adversary, how can you run it back with Jason Garrett? That's just so crazy to me.
First of all, we're going to be way better once we jettison Torrey Smith and find a way to add Jarvis Landry to the lineup. But in terms of that Dallas team, I think it's interesting to think of what that team could have been. I think this Zeke suspension is the reason that Jason Garrett still has a job, and there's a real argument to be made that Zeke should have just taken those first six games, sat down, and came back for the last 10, and this very well could be a playoff team at that point. But losing him in the middle of the season completely threw off everything. It was a different team when he came back. Tyron Smith was hurt. He didn't look the same. Dak regressed to more of the player I thought Dak was going to be and will be for his career. Played way above his head last year. The guy's just not that good. It was it was funny that people talked about Dak Prescott was the best quarterback in a class with Jared Goff and Carson Wentz. Just not the case. Big regression there. The issues with Dez are very obvious and you know, very problematic. He's probably gone from that team. Won't take a pay cut this day.
They have to cut him. They have to cut him.
Yeah,
like, he can't
pretty
get
much.
Open anymore.
No.
And if you're Dez, you know, not a guy that has amazing hands, and your physical gifts have kind of betrayed you at this point, which just happens, you know, like Father Time is undefeated. Like, but Dallas, I mean, them losing that game at home to Seattle in what essentially would have been a play-in game for them. I mean, that was pretty much all I needed to see. Like, Dak was bad. Dez, you know, he has late fumble or fumble in the second half. And then, I mean, they just were really, really bad. Like, it was surprising to me that that's how bad they were, considering, you know, Zeke was back. But I know Tyron Smith got hurt. I know, like, Sean Lee had some injuries and stuff like that. But to me, I wonder if, like, the locker room is a problem there. You know, you always wonder that, especially with how Dez is. And I agree. Like, I think Dak is just not – I don't know. He's not an
he's
elite
fine.
Quarterback.
Yeah, he's fine.
That's Do you think they make the playoffs this year with Tony Romo as their quarterback?
I know. I think Romo would have gotten killed. And one of the big things that people have to look at is, you know, last year that offensive line was generationally good. And this year you lose Doug Free before the season. Lael Collins has to swing out and play right tackle. You lose Ronald Leary to the Broncos. The depth is gone. Tyron Smith misses, you know, big chunks of the season. That offensive line went from a strength to a negative. And that offensive line covered up for a lot of problems with this team in the past. It made Zeke look a lot better than he is. Now he's good, for sure, but it made him look exceptional. It made Dak, you know, giving Dak that amount of time in the pocket to let receivers get open, to let plays develop, made him look exponentially better than he was. And when that started to go in the other direction, we saw that they couldn't compensate for it.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that the offensive line thing was tough. It was funny last year, right? Like, Cowboys fans were so quick to point out how good Dak was, and then everyone else was like, okay, well, Dak and Zeke are in the easiest situation of all time. And I do agree that the situation was good. Obviously, that doesn't take away from the seasons the two of them had. And Zeke Elliott is clearly very good. Like, there's no other way to slice that. Mm-hmm. But I kind of agree with what you said earlier. Like, just take the suspension to start the year.
Yep.
Like, and then figure it out from there, because it was so odd. And because by the time that he came back, it was, what, week 15 he comes back. Yeah. That's the game against Seattle. It's the biggest game on their schedule. And you could just tell, like, they just weren't ready to go.
Right.
And I just was kind of surprised about that, because I figured Zeke coming back would make it easier on Dak, and he was just still as bad. And part of the problem, I think, is that Dez Bryant is just not, you know, he's not a $10 million NFL receiver anymore. That's the biggest thing to me. Like, he's probably still a fine NFL receiver, but to be mentioned making the same type of money as, like, A.J. Green, Julio Jones, Odell Beckham, Antonio Brown, like, Dez is not even close to those guys anymore. He's just not that guy. And that's a big problem
more.
For a guy like Dak. Like, Dak can make a bunch of plays outside of the pocket, but, like, you need guys that – if your best receiver is Cole Beasley, it's not good enough, you know? It's just not. And so – that's to me where, like, if I'm Jerry Jones and I need to upgrade my roster, like, I need a coach that can help my guys a little bit more than Jason Garrett can.
Yeah, I mean, week 17, the Dallas Cowboys and the Philadelphia Eagles backups were 0-0 going into the fourth quarter. That's what
Cowboys team turned into. I think I blocked that game out of my memory, right? The Eagles lost 7-0, right?
6-0, yeah.
6-0, yeah. That's right. Dan Bailey couldn't make extra points after that.
Well,
like one of my really close friends against Seattle had this kid bet Seattle -6.5, even though Dallas was -6.5, and Dan Bailey missed two field goals under 45 yards, and Dallas obviously lost, I believe, 21-12 was the final score. And if Dan Bailey makes one of those field goals, he wins the bet. And at that point, Dan Bailey had been, like, the second most accurate kicker in NFL history.
Right.
It was just a bad gambling beat, but. It's, I don't know, like, Dallas is just so interesting to me, because I think there was a stat that the three longest teams from appearing in a conference championship are Dallas, Washington, and I believe the Cleveland Browns. And I think those teams have gone 20 years apiece. And that's a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was
especially for as good as they've been.
Yeah, that Cowboys defense let Nate Sudfeld set a record for efficiency for a quarterback. That's how bad that team was. Real quick, what's your Super Bowl prediction? Because we got to wrap this up.
I'm going to go New England and the Vikings, and I'm going to wait to see what we see from our boy Case Keenum until I give you a score.
Well,
but
you broke my heart. Know that you broke my heart, and you will never be invited back.
I'll tell you this, though. Upset as I am, I didn't get to fully Wally Pipp Onshu because he'll get his rollback next week. Mm-hmm. I am very excited to see Blake Bortles in New England. I would love nothing more than for him to come out with a win, just because I would love to see the fiery takes about roster building and Blake Bortles. And I want to see Malik Jackson yelling into the camera again that Jarrell Casey's sitting at home and they're playing in the Super Bowl. I'm really excited for that.
Well, I hope you get that and only with the Philadelphia Eagles playing and winning the Super Bowl in about 17 days. But for now, this has been take two of The Underdog, episode number 55. I've been Chris Hordell. He's been Tyler Lurie. Tyler, thanks for coming back for a second week and bailing us out.
Hey, Chris, anytime. I always have fun. Talk to you soon, man.